the headlines. Russia defends its decision to expel three European diplomats, saying that their expulsion was a result of their actions. Iran's foreign minister says that his country is ready to support the United Nations solution to end the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Myanmar's police use water cannon against protesters demanding the release of ex-leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained during a coup last Monday. This is Muse. Thanks for joining us. Russia defends its decision to expel a number of European Union diplomats for attending last month's protest in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Kremlin spokesman described the move as a consequence of the actions taken by some foreign diplomatic missions in Moscow during what he called unlawful rallies. Dmitry Peskov made it clear that Russia will not tolerate such behavior. Peskov, however, said that Russia remains interested in reviving relations with the European Union. On Friday, Moscow declared a Swedish, a Polish, and a German diplomat, persona non grata, for taking part in pro-Navalny protests. Russia has repeatedly said that Navalny's case is an internal affair and won't allow any foreign interference in it. Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. Iran's foreign minister has said that Tehran is ready to support the UN's solution to the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the remark in a meeting with the UN envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, in Tehran. Zarif stressed that a political solution is the only way to end the crisis. The UN envoy's visit to Tehran comes amid efforts to put an end to the six-year-long war that has led to the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Saudi Arabia started the onslaught in March 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemeni people, mostly women and children, have been killed and millions displaced since then. James Tweedy is a journalist and commentator who joins us from Plymouth. We also have Edward Corgan, who's a former UN peacekeeper, joining us from Limerick. I'd like to welcome you both. Edward Corgan, let me first start with you. This appears to be an effort by the U.S. after all these years to have the ball rolling on ending this war, and perhaps we're seeing one of those results being this visit by the UN special envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths. Iran has said that it's going to help assist this. Do you see this dynamic playing out?
I think it's very important that Martin Griffiths is actively involved at this point, and that Iran is also actively involved. However, I would make the point that it's 6 years too late. Probably in excess of over 200,000 people have died in Yemen, and the UN especially has not done nearly enough, not because it didn't want to, but because it wasn't allowed to. The reality is that three members of the UN Security Council, the US, Britain and France, had been actively supporting both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates in their war against the Yemeni people. Supplying millions of dollars worth of weapons. The Saudi war could not have been perpetrated without all the weapons supplied, but particularly by those three members of the UN Security Council, who should have a responsibility for maintaining international peace, not breaking it. So these recent developments are very welcome, but unfortunately 6 years too late for many of the people of Yemen itself.
James Sweedy, the fact that this UN envoy has paid a visit to Iran and having Iran to be part of that equation or solution, I should say, in order to see if there can be a resolution to this crisis is significant in itself, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is.
This will be for James Sweedy. I do apologize. James Sweedy, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for having me here. Yes, it's a step forward. And around support is a step forward, because although I don't accept the I'm skeptical of the claims that Iran is providing material support to the Ansar movement in Yemen, certainly it's providing political support to the Sanaa government. Maybe it's a step forward. I mean, certainly after 6 years in which the Saudi-led coalition has failed to, achieve its military aims. In fact, it's further away from those aims than it was perhaps a year ago now. It's about time that they cut their losses and sued for peace. I don't see a lot of good faith on the Saudi side and on the side of their allies, maybe not even from the UN. Certainly it's encouraging that the US made a small move in not directly supporting the Saudi military operations, and the way they were doing that was providing in-flight refueling tankers. The Saudis don't really need that. Yemen has a land border with Saudi Arabia. But we also see that the US government is now accusing the Ansar movement of attacking civilians in Saudi Arabia, because they have the capability to retaliate against Saudi Arabia's bombing of their country. But I'm not that encouraged by that. And unfortunately, the UN in recent years has shown some worrying signs in how it has dealt with other conflicts. For instance, it allowed the US and Britain and France and Italy to destroy Libya back in 2011. It didn't stop that war. And now, since then, it has imposed a government of its own choosing on Libya in Tripoli. I pointed out the so-called government of national unity, which has not achieved national unity. So, under the present Secretary General, unfortunately, the UN is showing some unfortunate tendencies. And I would wait to see what the UN actually proposes if talks go ahead, whether it, for instance, proposes having an election to see whether the Yemeni people want to have the former President Hadi back, or whether they propose some kind of fudge of a government of national unity, or with Hadi sharing power with some leaders from the Ansar movement.
Edward Horgan, if the will is there, is the big question on the part of Saudi Arabia to want to end this war. At this point, the U.S. has said that it's going to roll back supplying weapons, even though it did say that it's still going to provide defensive, quote-unquote defensive type weapons to Yemen. Now, you have the U.K., for example, who will be holding that spot of being the supplier of weapons to Saudi Arabia should Prime Minister Boris Johnson decide to continue that. So do you think the will is there from Saudi Arabia to want to end this war?
I think it might be at this point, but clearly the will is also there in the countries like the UK, France, Germany, and the United States to sell as many weapons as possible. So I think what Biden has done so far is a small step forward, but only a small step forward. The issue of accountability, I think, is a huge one. Who will be held accountable, in particular for the starvation of tens of thousands of children who were literally starved to death? Hopefully the efforts to stop the war will be successful. But the issue of accountability, I think, is a huge one. The fact that it is 6 years too late, the war should never have started in the first place. And when it did, the UN should have been allowed to intervene to prevent the war continuing. The problem is with the UN Security Council and the veto, and when you have three veto members on the Security Council, the US, UK and France, actively supporting one side in gross breach of the UN Charter and in gross breach of all humanitarian principles, this is a problem not only in Yemen, but as the previous speaker mentioned, also in Libya, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq. It's a huge problem that appears to be getting worse rather than better. So I'm optimistic in the short term that some progress will be made. But in the long term, we need to make progress in getting rid of the veto on the UN Security Council and holding those who are engaged in international terrorism on a huge scale to account.
Thank you for that, Edward Horgan. Former UN peacekeeper there from Limerick, James Tweedy, thank you. Journalist and commentator from Plymouth. And that does it for our news review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. Iran says it will not return to its obligations under the nuclear deal unless the U.S. removes all the sanctions against the country. A correspondent, Yusuf Jalali, has followed the story through Iran's foreign ministry and has filed this report.
You first, me next. Since Joe Biden became the new U.S. president, Tehran and Washington have each been asking the other side to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. On Sunday, Joe Biden said the U.S. will not lift the sanctions until Iran stops enriching uranium.
Will the U.S. lift sanctions first in order to get Iran back to the negotiating table?
No.
They have to stop enriching uranium first.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, however, made it clear, saying his country will live up to its commitments only if the U.S. removes the sanctions it illegally reimposed against Tehran. Once hailed as a victory for diplomacy, the nuclear deal has been hanging in the balance since former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled his country out of the international accord and reinstated sanctions against Iran in 2018. In return, Tehran began a gradual suspension of its nuclear commitments, the last of which was the resumption of uranium enrichment at 20% purity. In December last year, the Iranian parliament also passed a bill requiring the government to limit the International Atomic Energy Agency's inspection of the country's nuclear sites. The law also tasked the government to pull Iran out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty as of February the 20th. I asked Iran's foreign ministry spokesman if Tehran is determined to do so. He said, it's up to the U.S.
It's the choice of the U.S. and the EU whether Iran implement a new law or not. Based on the schedule, on February 20, we will suspend the implementation of the NPT and restrict the IAEA inspections, and we have informed the IAEA about this plan. The U.S. and Europe could stop this from happening by returning to their obligations. All our steps are reversible.
Since the U.S. left the deal, the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action have been trying to save the deal, which promised Iran the lifting of the sanctions in return for the country curbing its nuclear program. Iran says the three European parties to the pact have done nothing to offset the impact of the U.S.'s withdrawal from the accord. The Islamic Republic says its steps towards suspending its JCPOA commitments are within the framework of the nuclear deal and seek to keep the balance between its obligations and rights under the agreement.
Now, as Tehran and Washington are stuck in a standoff, Iran says the ball is in the U.S. court. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that there's only one way ahead to save the deal. The U.S. should lift the sanctions. Or else, Tehran says it will continue to scale back its obligations to the JCPOA. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Britain and the European Union have requested that the UN Human Rights Council hold a special session in response to the ongoing political crisis in Myanmar. The motion has the support of 19 others of the Council's 47 members, fulfilling the requirement for the backing of at least a third of the Council's members. On Monday, Myanmar police used water cannon to disperse nationwide protests against last week's military coup. Martial law was also declared in the country's second-largest city, Mandalay. Demonstrators have been demanding the immediate release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and a handover of power to the elected politicians. Suu Kyi and key government officials were detained by the military in a pre-dawn raid last week. The death toll from a glacier disaster in India has risen to 26, as 171 people are still missing. The bodies of the victims are being pulled out from under the debris as search and rescue operations continue for possible survivors. The tragedy unfolded as a massive chunk of the Himalayan glacier in northern India broke off over the weekend. The incident triggered devastating flooding after the piece of ice crashed into and destroyed a dam in the state of Uttarakhand. Most of those missing are workers of the hydropower plants in the area. Rescue teams are trying to access dozens of workers believed to be trapped in a tunnel at one of the power plants. Palestinians in the blockade Gaza Strip have expressed their solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners who continue to languish in Israeli prisons. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have held a sit-in in front of the Red Cross office to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights, including access to proper medical care during the coronavirus pandemic. Last month, Israeli regime forces arrested 456 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including women and minors. Hamas movement demanded international protection for Palestinian prisoners.
Zionist practices against Palestinian prisoners violate all international laws and norms. We came here to express a united stance in solidarity with the prisoners. We call on all international organizations to intervene and protect Palestinian prisoners, especially during the coronavirus pandemic.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are being held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. The plight of Palestinian prisoners has increased amid the coronavirus pandemic. Around 400 of them have been infected with a deadly virus.
We call on the International Committee of the Red Cross to help Palestinian prisoners who continue to suffer inside Israeli jails. We are deeply concerned over the prisoners who suffer from medical negligence. More and more prisoners are infected with the coronavirus because of the overcrowding and lack of hygiene products.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation.
Continuing the resistance is the key to liberate the prisoners, including by capturing Israeli soldiers to swap them with Palestinian inmates. We also need to increase solidarity activities to support the prisoners and highlight their suffering in Israeli prisons.
Solidarity with Palestinian prisoners has been a top priority for activists in Gaza, who say they are determined to stand by the prisoners for as long as it takes.
Latest statistics show that Israel has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Currently, thousands of prisoners are kept inside Israeli jails, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears in court to formally respond to corruption charges against them. Netanyahu has pleaded not guilty to the charges against them. The Monday hearing marks the beginning of the trial proper, with subsequent sessions focused on testimony and evidence. Meanwhile, a large crowd of protesters gathered outside of the court in Jerusalem Al-Quds. Netanyahu was charged last year over allegations of accepting improper gifts and seeking to trade regulatory favor with media moguls in exchange for positive coverage, but he claims to be the victim of a witch hunt. The trial schedule may force Netanyahu to appear in court multiple times a week. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
من زر خاک وطنم من This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Hi everyone, this is John. You're with me for another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. Former President Donald Trump and Pentagon were not of the same opinion about the future of the U.S. military in Afghanistan. And now, everybody is waiting to see how President Biden plays his first move ever since he came to power. Biden might not like to follow the policies of the previous administration, which apparently were decreasing its presence in Afghanistan. But what are his choices? Prolonging the war and bearing the responsibility for the lives of more American soldiers? Or abiding by Trump's deal with the Taliban?
Donald Trump and his administration have been the flag bearers of an America First dogma. The translation of such policies into the ground in Afghanistan is a hasty withdrawal without feeling any responsibility for the security void it may create and the destructive repercussions that may follow two decades of U.S. war in the country. There are numerous formal or informal hidden or exposed forces with conforming or conflicting interests at work in Afghanistan. One of the active forces for the last 20 years was the US-led military, and now Washington is reducing its force there as part of a deal with its long-fought enemy. The pact that is being honed and publicized during talks in Doha has no realistic or feasible action plan. Many politicians and military commanders view it as one of Trump's failed stunts for re-election and expect the Biden administration to abandon the America First policy and weigh in the options and their consequences with more concrete measures. But will Biden trust Trump's artisan entente?
Biden picked the retired General Lloyd J. Austin as the new Secretary of Defense. The general was the top commander of American forces in Iraq in 2010 when the U.S. still had 50,000 service members there. Back then, General Austin and his commanders wanted a substantial force of over 5,000 troops to remain help the fledgling Iraqi military. But the Obama administration overruled their judgment and pulled out all forces by the end of 2011. So, will Biden go with the Obama policy? Well, new National Security Advisor recently said that the current administration is taking a look at the extent to which the Taliban are complying with the conditions set out in the agreement. If the agreement fails, some say that the U.S. may use ISIS to try to take control away from the Taliban in Afghanistan.
For Biden, sticking to Trump's plan means trusting Taliban's future behavior after the U.S. forces left. As per their pact, Taliban will be the protector of U.S. interests against about two dozens of other terrorist groups, some of which have been fighting alongside the Taliban against the Afghan government and U.S. forces for the last 20 years. Taliban has already urged Biden to abide by the agreement, but is the new president as optimistic and positive about the actualization of the deal? Can Taliban be trusted as a counter-terrorism strategy? If Biden follows the course that was set by Trump, one big probable outcome may be the rise of the affiliates to Takfiri group Daesh or ISIL in Afghanistan, not unlike what happened in Iraq. Recently, Daesh followers in Afghanistan have raised the scope and number of their attacks and are establishing relations with other Takfiri groups across the country to build up a bigger force, paving the way for another leap to power once the time was ripe.
Now, for more on this, we are joined by Mr. Tim Anderson. He's the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies. Mr. Anderson, welcome to the show. So, what do you think the so-called war on terror has brought in for the Afghan people?
It brought them terrible misery, because as the Afghan former Member of Parliament, Malalai Joya, said, from having, and she was an opponent of the Taliban government, she said, from having one enemy, we went to having three enemies. We had enemies in the sky, we had the occupation forces, the Taliban, the warlords. So the US intervention in Afghanistan, and it was an illegal invasion, just as illegal as the invasion of Iraq, brought a regime of terror to the Afghan people, and they're only starting to emerge from it. Of course, it hasn't changed the dominance of the Taliban in domestic politics. Indeed, it seems to have entrenched that. But they've had two decades of terror and foreign occupation, and there is no country that develops and builds its human capacity, its dignity from foreign occupation. No country does that.
All right, you think that it has brought misery and reign of terror. So the rise of the Takfiri terrorist group Daesh, or ISIL, was concurrent with the Democrat president in office, Obama. Can another Democrat like Biden at the helm mean there is another Takfiri uprising looming for Afghanistan?
That's not entirely clear. It's certainly true that the Democrat administrations have relied to a greater extent on what they call smart power, that is to say, getting other people to fight their dirty wars. So the Obama administration, with Biden as vice president, certainly increased the scale of the use of Takfiri terrorism across the region. And let's remember that was in Lebanon as well as in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan, and used against Iran in some respects too, used in Yemen, for example, not used against Israel, of course. And that tells us the nature of Takfiri terrorism in the region. It came as a blowback to some countries, some of the Arab monarchies of the Persian Gulf. It came as a blowback to some of the NATO powers in Europe. But it was escalated substantially under a Democrat administration. It was created under a Republican administration. If we go back to 2006, when the Bush administration's Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, said in Tel Aviv, prior to the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, that they wanted to use a creative chaos to reshape the region, to create a new Middle East. Effectively, this has been the strategy set in place by the Bush administration, carried through with this slogan of smart power by the Obama administration, reluctantly adopted in many respects by the Trump administration, but the deep state made sure there was continuity there. Now, it's not yet clear whether the new Biden administration is going to make some adjustments, make some strategic retreats, for example. There is talk in the U.S. military, and notably the new defense Secretary of Defense and his advisor, the talk of creating a new line in the Middle East to the north of Jordan and Israel, and allowing their so-called partners, for example, Turkey under Mr. Erdogan, to fight with Iraq and Syria for control of North Iraq and Syria, for example. So it's not clear to what extent that has percolated through into the military-industrial complex of the U.S. But certainly a Democrat administration, Democratic administrations have always been those which have placed greater emphasis on a propaganda war, placed greater emphasis on using irregular forces, terrorist groups, as opposed to direct occupations and direct invasions.
According to the U.S. Taliban deal, after the military pullout, Washington relies on the Taliban as a counter-terrorism force against Daesh or Al-Qaeda or other such extremist groups. Do you think the Biden administration would go on with this strategy?
The Biden administration is in a smooth continuity with the former Obama administration, and to some extent the Trump administration, in supporting the Al-Qaeda groups, the Daesh groups in the entire region. We know that in the last few years, the U.S. Occupation forces in the region have moved Daesh resources from Syria and Iraq, when they've been defeated there, across to Afghanistan, where they have been fighting Taliban. And whatever we think of the Taliban as extremists, they are indigenous extremists, and they have been essentially fighting a very successful resistance against the most powerful military on earth. Now, the Biden administration, Joe Biden in particular, when he was vice president, admitted in late 2014 that many of the U.S. close allies in the region, in particular the Saudis, Turkey under Mr. Erdogan, the Emirates, had been funding and arming Daesh and al-Nusra, HTS these days, precisely to weaken the administration in Damascus, just as they had used it to weaken the administration in Baghdad and try to prevent a effective coalition between Tehran and Baghdad. So we know, it's an open secret, that the U.S. has indirectly at least, and in many respects directly, supported Daesh in the region. So it's a nice piece of North American doublespeak to say that they are relying on the Taliban to fight Daesh. Of course, the Taliban is fighting Daesh because Daesh are an imposed Takfiri force to try and weaken and divide Afghanistan. The U.S. would not like to see an independent united Afghanistan, just as they don't want to see an independent and united Iraq, Syria, Palestine, Lebanon, rest of the independent states there. So the Taliban is going to be left as the dominant force in Afghanistan. Yes, they will fight Daesh, but the U.S. role has always been to try and weaken and divide and destabilize the independent states of the region.
All right, thank you so much, Mr. Anderson, for being with us. Let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Halima Khalid believes that the Biden administration's stance on the U.S.-Taliban deal, SPEC and the BRI project shows whether they're seeking stability in the region or more chaos. Dougie Oakes mentions that in spite of the fact that the new administration tries to have people believe that it cares about the poor people amid the COVID pandemic, history has shown that they didn't care about the poor people of the Middle East. Masume also believes that Biden should put Afghanistan's war in priority. Zamrai Ach opines that finally, after all, Biden will follow the lead of Trump regarding the Afghanistan issue.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Some say that Washington's military decision in Iraq led to the surge of Daesh to power, and that the Takfiri terrorists killed their way through until they had large areas of territory in eastern Syria and northern Iraq, the size of Britain under their control in June 2014. General Austin, who was the principal military architect of the U.S.-led campaign against ISIL, drafted a war plan to directly provide ammunition and weapons to other forces fighting the Takfiris on ground under an increased air campaign from Incirlik Air Base in Turkey. The new Secretary of Defense may have similar plans for Afghanistan.
The reality is absurdly grim for the longest war in U.S. history, which started in the wake of the 11th of September 2001 attacks and had over 3,500 U.S.-led coalition casualties and at least 110,000 Afghan deaths, and still counting. Taliban, the principal enemy, is surging ahead with more than half of Afghanistan already under its physical control, and the U.S. is facilitating the implementation of a deal to give Taliban even more control and power. Washington hopes that the terrorist group will guarantee the safety of Americans and their allies against other less dominant terrorist outfits. Afghan people are less hopeful or naive about a peaceful future. They have seen history repeating itself over and over in their country. They have seen that the tribes and groups which had been at war with each other evicted the British forces in 1919, pushed out the Russians in the late 1980s, and are now wearing out U.S. forces.
The story of Afghanistan and the U.S. deal with the Taliban is also reminiscent of the ostensible peace accords in 1973 to end the war and restore peace in Vietnam, which had allowed the supposed honorable withdrawal of the U.S. troops immediately after the deal was signed. The communists overran the entire country. A similar augury may come about in Afghanistan unless Biden opts for a different path.
The last time a Democrat president was at the helm of the White House, the whole world was under the constant and expanding threat of Daesh. To prevent disasters such as the regrowth of Daesh or Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, the incoming administration must reconsider its promises of ending forever wars. The new U.S. administration may withdraw American forces and instead give high-tech weaponry to Taliban and other selected bands of terrorists to fight the other bad guys for them, while U.S. provides air support from bases in neighboring countries. A similar strategy was the fulcrum of U.S. war against ISIL in Iraq. Biden has said he supports smaller U.S. military missions that would work with local troops in Afghanistan to prevent a resurgence of Takfiri terrorism. But how many troops are needed to keep a serious and robust base to protect U.S. interests and prevent a Takfiri takeover? An ill-planned chain of decisions by Biden may help Takfiri terrorists grow in number and power, making the country even more vulnerable to a Takfiri resurgence once the military forces leave. Daesh may resurrect this time in Afghanistan, while another U.S. administration wants to end another war.
We are joined by Mr. Mohammad Dawood Meraki. He's an Afghan activist and a political analyst. Mr. Meraki, welcome to the show. So, the Pentagon and Trump did not agree with the U.S. military withdrawal. Do you think Biden would follow the announced course set by Trump?
Well, Pentagon is in the business of war. It has throughout advocated war and destruction. After all, that's what they do. Obama back in the day when the surge was being advocated by them, and then also Trump realized in 2017, August of 2017 when he gave in to Pentagon's maneuvers and decided to add 4,000 troops in Afghanistan. And so Biden has learned that lesson from them, and I think he will be more careful. And he, after all, Biden was the only dissenting voice in the Obama administration against the surge in 2008 and 2009. And based on his rhetoric throughout the pre-election as well as post-election, it appears he's going to follow up on the issues of troop withdrawal from Afghanistan.
All right, do you think Biden will be more careful and not follow through? Some people say that Biden is left with a dead end in Afghanistan, and some say he is left with a big choice. What are the options for Biden?
It all depends on how he looks at the situation. And based on the historical, past 20 years, the war in Afghanistan has been a complete defamation for the United States at the international forum. The United States has been viewed as an aggressor. It has committed war crimes, and it has, the reputation, that whatever type of positive reputation, has been tainted significantly. And of course, at home, there is no support for the war. Majority of the people want the troops to come home, and equally, the financial cost, $2 trillion, wasting Afghanistan and killing people, bombing places. They have not released. If they use those $2 trillion, rebuilding Afghanistan, Afghanistan would be the Paris of Asia. But unfortunately, those $2 trillion simply changed hands and came back to the bank accounts of those who advocate war and destruction. And the military industrial complex made money, and everybody else did not see anything, or, of course, in Afghanistan, but dead in destruction. And a few corrupt officials have been propped up and maintained in that country. So they don't have much of a choice. You see, there is a clear-cut decision based on the agreement that was signed between the United States and Taliban in February of this year. And that agreement actually, they stipulated conditions for the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and those conditions have been, for the most part, met. The agreement was not signed between Trump per se and certain individuals in Afghanistan, but rather representing a country and a movement. And the agreement was signed, and the agreement was also ratified by the Security Council, and has given the appropriate credentials needed as a legitimate document. So the document is there, and that document can serve as a benchmark upon which they can formulate their policy. So on one hand, they have their own problem situation, foreign policy issues, domestic issues. Then we have an established credential or document that was being signed as a Doha agreement, and I think that could serve as a benchmark and as a roadmap, if you will, for what needs to be done next, which is, of course, complete withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Mr. Meraki, before moving ahead, let's just take a quick look at media views regarding this problem.
Attacks on Afghan forces have intensified since the signing of the U.S.-Taliban agreement. Coordinated assaults on civilians, including students, continue, and negotiations between the Taliban and Afghan government have failed to yield any results. A reduced U.S. military presence in Afghanistan could put incoming President Joe Biden in a tough position as he takes over. Many experts and military officials in the U.S. believe the conditions on the ground are not right for a radical reduction of U.S. military in Afghanistan. Analysts believe it is unlikely for Biden to reject the U.S.-Taliban deal, as his priorities would be to solve more urgent domestic issues rather than getting into a disagreement with the Taliban. However, Biden might keep a small number of counterterrorism troops in the country to ensure America is not under threat from armed groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL, ISIS or Daesh. This will make the Taliban more accountable to fulfill one of the core tenets of the U.S.-Taliban agreement, to break ties with Al-Qaeda, something Taliban has avoided so far. The United States today is undermining the foundations of an international order manifestly advantageous to U.S. interests, reflecting a basic ignorance of the extent to which both robust alliances and international institutions provide vital strategic depth, former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says. In practice, America First has meant America alone, making the nation more vulnerable to emerging threats. Mattis and his co-authors urge the new Biden administration to show more deference to allies' concerns in joining with the U.S. to face global challenges.
Welcome back, Mr. Meraki, and welcome back to the audience as well. So, Mr. Meraki, you earlier said that after wasting $2 trillion and bombing Afghanistan, they're not left with many choices. How is Washington involved in the rise of Daesh and increase of their Takfiri terrorist attacks in Afghanistan?
Well, the Daesh issue is, of course, complicated. It is not only the United States, but rather also it was a project advocated by the British to basically balance the Taliban's insurgency and something else they can formulate on the side so they can use that to defeat Taliban. But it backfired because it did not fulfill the environment in Afghanistan is not similar to that in the Arab countries in the Middle East. The values are different here. Daesh cannot transfer in Afghanistan cannot advance their, their Takfiri goals in this country. Incidentally, in order to balance to create another movement to kind of use that and fight that, utilize that against Taliban, they have included majority of the personnel in Daesh or in Takfiri movement are about 90%+ are non-Pashtuns. So they thought by creating this, they could go ahead and balance the Taliban insurgency, and then they could kind of, kind of twist the logic they used. They could cancel each other out or whatever that might have been.
And that was our episode regarding the election of Joe Biden and its consequences for Afghanistan. We'll meet next week.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to the program, Ulama Speech. In today's program, we're going to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. Please stay tuned.
تصورم اینه که
در این موقعیت لازم بود یک ارزشیابی از گذشته انقلاب بشه.
I humbly think that at this time it was necessary that an analysis of the Islamic revolution's past was conducted. And for the future, two sets of factors should be studied. One is positive factors and favorable conditions and the resources for the continuation and progress of the Islamic revolution. It is necessary for them to be understood and to be strengthened. And the other is in contrast to this, that is, the dangers and threats which should be answered and resolved and weakened. These dangers are of a few kinds. One danger is that of the foundation of thinking, where they say, who said an Islamic revolution is necessary? Or what necessity is there for this revolution to be Islamic? Or if it is an Islamic revolution, it should relate to the religious issues only. What does it have to do with non-religious issues? Or is it even possible that this revolution continues on forever? They say that a revolution is a social phenomenon, like other phenomena, and thus has a lifespan and a time where it dies off. Every born being is born at some point in time. It passes a certain time span, youth, strength, oldness, and then dies. This revolution is also like that. They say it has lived for 40 years, and that's good enough. It's time for it to end. They say, why is it necessary that it continues? Or other doubts and thoughts like, the conditions of the Islamic revolution have changed. Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.